Hey, everybody. Welcome into the podcast. We are back with another special bonus episode. Brad, I am so freaking pumped for today because we get to drink. I mean, just I don't even think it's like categorically true that this is our favorite brand of whiskey in the world, right?
Yeah. I mean, ever since season one, I mean, so early in this podcast, we knew literally nothing about scotch. I think the one thing we knew about scotch was that it was, in fact, whiskey.
Yeah. And from Scotland.
And it was from Scotland. Yeah. Two things. We knew two things about scotch, and we picked up a sampler pack of Glenmorangie. We then learned how to pronounce Glenmorangie, and we drank it and talked about it on the show. And the Quinta Rubin, back then they were doing the 12-year and 14-year. The Quinta Rubin 12-year was in that pack. We lost our minds. We got the 14-year. We loved it. We have been Glenmorangie fanboys ever since. We're 3 years into the podcast almost now, and we can't stop talking about it. And here today, Bob, we're just so excited about our guest.
Yeah. I have been searching high and low for somebody from the Glenmorangie Corporation to come on our show so we can just laud them for everything they're doing. And we finally found someone willing to come on and accept those platitudes. And we have with us today Dan Kroll, who is the national brand ambassador for Glenmorangie. Dan, we've just been getting to know him off air a little bit. I think everyone is in for a treat today. I'm not going to say any more about his background besides that, but he is freaking amazing. Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm honored to be here, and thanks for giving me the time of day, and looking forward to chatting with you about all kinds of stuff.
I don't know like what you would call the opposite of being on the hot seat, but that's your position today is just like you're just going to sit there and listen to us tell you how awesome you and your company are. So
great. I can do that.
So, Dan, I mean, it is kind of rare for us to have someone that's a brand ambassador on the show. Typically, we have, you know, executives or distillers on the show. So somebody that's on more of like the marketing PR side, it's really cool to have someone from your point of view coming on. And I guess I just want to start with, how do you get to become the Glenmorangie brand ambassador? Like, were you a whiskey industry guy, or did you just kind of work your way up through the ranks of ambassadoring for other things?
No, actually, and you know, we were chatting a little bit before, and you alluded to the correct answer, which is this is not the kind of job that you seek out. It sort of finds you. My background was almost entirely accidental. I went to music school, left music school to be in a rock band, and that, of course, led me to the bar and restaurant industry. I remember one of my first trainers, my first restaurant job was, and it was like, okay, you're here. Are you an actor, artist, or musician? and it kind of bore itself out because everybody's just looking for, at that point, was looking for cash in hand, flexible work. You could leave and come back and still have a job. And so I did that for quite a long time until I decided to leave working for someone else and attempt to work for myself as an entrepreneur within that, within the bar and restaurant industry. And that I learned a lot, we'll kind of put it that way. And so when that collapsed in a heap of horrifying terror, I ended up getting a job with a distributor here in Nebraska, and I worked there managing the on-premise team and being the educator for spirits educator for the Omaha market, the Lincoln market, and for the in-house team. So that was my first step into education and advocacy. It just so happened that there's a whiskey bar here in Omaha that back then, and it's becoming that again now. Back then, it was a world-renowned whiskey bar disguised as a fish and chips place called the Dundee Dell. And so we would see people in Omaha floating through this place that we had no business having contact with, including the global master brand ambassador for Glenmorangie, David Blackmore, and our master distiller for Glenmorangie and Ardbeg, Dr. Bill Lumsden. And so I established contact with those guys, stayed in touch with them, went to Whiskey Fest Chicago and saw them there, and just sort of kept my finger in their ear until such time as the U.S. brand ambassador team went from David to more than David. And I eventually got a shot at sitting down and interviewing with the brand team and eventually got the gig. But it wasn't, it was a typically circuitous route, just like a lot of the folks that do this kind of thing for a living.
Well, and I'm curious, Dan, that for a lot of Americans, I feel like their route into the world of scotch, and I'm speaking of drinking it, of course, is pretty circuitous, that most people I hear describe it as gasoline, and I only drink bourbon. I only drink Jack Daniels. I only drink bourbon. I don't touch that stuff. Even your sophisticated American palates, are the only thing they're searching out is the BTAC stuff, right? So for you then, what was it like to get into the world of drinking scotch? What was it like to find yourself not just drinking scotch, but representing scotch as an American?
It's funny you should mention the Americans' attachment to bourbon or American whiskeys in general. Bourbon was born with the country. It grew up with the country, and so we all have bourbon woven into our DNA as citizens of the U.S. and whether we know it or not. So there's a direct kind of fierce connection and defense of that category. And I respect the hell out of that. I love bourbon like it's my own child. But when I got my job at the distributorship, I had just lost my business, and there was horrifying debt involved and that kind of thing. And the thing that I thought when I got that job was, I got to find a way to keep this job. So as the de facto educator in the building, I found the thing that everyone else knew the least about, and dedicated my time to knowing the most about it, so that when our license holding customers would come to us and ask anyone in the building about, okay, what can you tell me about single malt Scotch whiskey? Because that was the one category that everybody had the most questions about, everybody was the most afraid of, and none of my colleagues knew a damn thing about it. So I figured if all of them, when posed the question, okay, tell me about single malt, if all of them uniformly just pointed at me and said, you got to talk to that guy, then the likelihood I would get fired was going to go way down.
Yeah, it was all about job security.
Totally. Because it's as a category, it can be daunting, intimidating. It can be, it seems exclusionary. It seems prescriptive. All of these things that kind of have a bit of a razor wire barrier around the category, not to mention some of it tastes like Dante's Inferno. So you've got all of these things that create these barriers to entry for people. And the more I dug into it, the more I was like, wait a minute, those don't need to be there. And education and advocacy are the answer to reducing the barriers of entry to an amazing and complex category that has such diversity and such a broad continuum of flavor characteristics mm-hmm. available to the consumer, that there, without it being too much of a slogan, there really is a Scotch whiskey for every palate. It just doesn't seem like there is to the casual observer.
Well, and I think that's a perfect kind of natural segue into talking about the brand itself. So most of our listenership are kind of at the entry level with whiskey in general. Like, we don't have a lot of people that are, nitpicking about mash bills and things like that and different types of finishes. They just want to know that they can go into their local liquor store and find something that's a good value. And I think that is initially what put Glenmorangie really like at the forefront of our reviews. When we review whiskey, we have five categories that we review it by. So it's nose, taste, finish, balance, and then the last one is value. Because for the average consumer, there's only so many times you can listen to somebody review a BTAC, for example, and then hearing the price tag at the end, it's like, oh, cool, I hope I get to try that someday. You've got Glenmorangie here that's sitting on the shelf, and this 14-year Quinta Rubin is $50. And I mean, to this day, it's the best value we've ever found of any whiskey in the world. And I have a ton of questions about it, but I think my first question would be, what is it specifically about Glenmorangie that I think appealed to guys like us who were just starting to get into the world of scotch? But then also, like, on top of that, we keep coming back to it and we keep finding layers of complexity that we don't find in other whiskeys that I would call kind of like gateway whiskeys. So You know, in your opinion, why does Glenmorangie work both as a gateway whiskey and also as something for the seasoned vet?
Well, to your point, the complexity has a tremendous amount to do with it. Sometimes, like if you equate it to the newspaper is written to a sixth grade reading level so that more people have access to the information, but the information is presented in a simplified way. Whereas if you happen to be, you know, you're at the Art Institute of Chicago and there's a giant Jackson Pollock. Jackson Pollock didn't do anything in order to make you feel more comfortable about what he was doing. There's complexity, but lacking approachability, whereas the newspaper is approachable but lacks complexity. When you try to find a sweet spot that achieves both effectively, it's really difficult to do. Mm-hmm. Glenmorangie is one of those whiskeys that comes along and is supremely approachable, even from a price perspective, but from a flavor profile perspective as well. And yet, it has tremendous depth and complexity to it that doesn't set you off or confuse your palate or alienate you from the category as an entry level or fledgling budding whiskey enthusiast. That it's that intersection of complexity and approachability that I think Glenmorangie hits as well as any whiskey in the world, I think.
All right, so I want to pull back a little bit and just kind of ask you something that I think is a little more fun here. Let's assume that you are new to the world of Scotch. You're trying Glenmorangie for the first time. Maybe you are, like Brad was talking about, an American who's used to drinking bourbon and maybe rye. What would you, Dan, recommend like pairing up with your Glenmorangie as you first give it a try? Would you go with like a certain type of food? Would you go with a certain type of dessert? What would you recommend to somebody who's looking to really get the most out of that experience as they pair it with something else?
Yeah. There's a lot of different directions that you can go. If you are dedicating yourself as a sort of a student of the culinary aspects of enjoying Glenmorangie, and you decide that you're going to sit down and you do a charcuterie plate or a cheese plate, some dried fruits, some nuts, maybe some, you know, honeycomb honey, those kinds of things, then I think I would do some dried fruits, specifically dates. Dried apricots, possibly like dried orange peel, like dried, even slightly desiccated or candied orange peel. Super fascinating. Some mild white cheeses, mild to medium sharpness, and mild to medium veining in terms of like blue cheeses and things. You could blow a lot of Glenmorangies out of the water with a super stinky blue cheese. Milk chocolates, dark chocolates, prosciutto, jamón ibérico, and things like that. Those work really well. Citrus and floral and honeyed, anything is going to work terrifically with pretty much anything in the Glenmorangie range. And then when you get a little bit more hyper-focused on the specific SKUs, whether it's La Santa Quinta Nectar d'Or, some of the ones that we'll be talking about, those would have more specific pairing components associated with them. But as a broad ranging idea, dried fruits, citrus, honey, mild cheeses, mild to medium cheeses, and mild to medium cured meats would be great.
So, you know, just because not all of our audience can go with the Iberico ham, which Taco Bell item would you pair it up with?
Oh, nice. Really, okay. Yeah. No, I think that's an important one. One of the first things that I would do at a Taco Bell would be to get those damned things that are tossed in cinnamon and sugar.
Those cinnamon twists.
Yes.
Hell
those
yeah.
With any of the Glenmorangies would be fantastic. I might do a crunch wrap. With La Santa would be outstanding. Now that I'm thinking about it.
See, this is the hard hitting content that people come to.
Yes.
Us for. I love the fact that you took that question seriously.
I was literally about to interrupt you and be like, Dan, you do not have to answer that question.
No, it's a practical application of what it is that we do. You know, Taco Bell is ubiquitous. You know, we sell a lot of whiskey. So those things are bound to intersect in some people's lives. And it should be engineered in such a way to try to secure the maximum amount of success possible.
At some college dorm somewhere, there is a frat guy drinking Glenmorangie and eating Taco Bell at this moment.
Yes. And congratulations, sir or madam.
They finally feel seen, you know?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Well, if I can make the greatest segue of all time, something else that is ubiquitous in our lives is the presence of movies. And Dan, you are here to talk to us today about your favorite movie, which is a film that I can say with certainty has not been discussed on this show before. So why don't you reveal to our listeners what your favorite film is?
I will do that. My favorite film on the planet in mankind's history is the 1970 Dustin Hoffman film, Little Big Man. It is, I feel like it is a stunning cinematic achievement. Mm. And I, you know, it may not be everybody's cup of Joe, and some folks, and just in the past couple of days, I've just been reading a few like new and old reviews, and some people kind of slight it for being a little overwrought in places or being a little long-winded in other places. It just speaks to my soul in ways that no other movie really has ever done.
I mean, I think as a movie, I don't know how many people in our audience will have seen it, but you know, when it was released, it was a big deal, especially because of the way that Hoffman ages throughout the movie. Like, I think, you know, he ages from a young man to like 104, whatever, however old he's supposed to be at the end of the film. But I think that movie sits at a really interesting intersection in American cinema. Like, you had just had this kind of revolutionary year in 67, and Hoffman was at the forefront of that with The Graduate. And this movie really does kind of have those same kind of almost like Sam Peckinpah vibes of late era Western, but getting at something a little more deep about what we think of the American West and things like that. So I guess when you look at the movie, like, what is it that attracts you to it? Is it that kind of edgier 70s vibe that it has to it? Is it, you know, the central performance of Hoffman, or like, what keeps bringing you back to it?
I think what works for me, the cinematography, I think, is really stunning. The music, John P. Hammond is the fellow that did the soundtrack, and it is so beautifully paired with the vibe of the movie, which runs an immense gamut from you know, comical to absolute gut-wrenching tragedy, and everything in between, all set in this kind of ruggedness of the American West at that point. I think the fact that it is able to tread so much ground so sort of deftly and cleverly, with an unvarnished viewpoint. To your point, it happened during the Vietnam War. There's a scene in the movie involving Custer invading a camp full of essentially women and children, and just sort of slaughtering everything in sight. And there was a particular episode during the Vietnam War that the U.S. Army had done something very similar right at the time that this movie was being shot and came out. So a lot of people took it as a thinly veiled indictment of U.S. foreign policy and the, you know, the sort of the folly of the Vietnam War. So when you look at it as an allegory for what was happening in society at that point, it even becomes more of a stunning statement. But if you took all that away, the idea that it gave Native Americans, finally, it gave Native Americans the canvas that they had deserved all along, that showed them to be who they really were, as opposed to who we were supposed to believe that they were. You know, it forced white America to sort of look at what had been wrought against and on these folks from the very beginning. So I like the honesty of it. I like the unflinching nature of how it looks at that period in history. And Richard Mulligan as Custer it's a stunning performance. Dustin Hoffman, of course, is absolutely magnetized. You can't take your eyes off him in every scene that he's in. Faye Dunaway, of course, anything that she's ever done, she's luminous. And in this case, she runs her character. Her character arc is an amazingly deep and broad character arc, and she plays both ends of it so sublimely well that it's just, as an amalgam, it's a movie that I absolutely adore it.
Brad, I noticed that you've been suspiciously quiet during this conversation on Little Big Man. You know, Dan, I don't know how much of our podcast you've been able to listen to, but part of the conceit of the podcast is that Brad has not seen a lot of these kind of older or classic movies. And so we're introducing him to them for the first time. Brad, your level of awareness of this movie prior to 4 minutes ago?
All I have to say, Bob, is when I looked up the IMDb page for this and I saw that Faye Dunaway was in it, I immediately went, oh, she was great in Network. So,
oh, nice.
I'm so proud of you.
I'm just saying.
I feel so proud.
I'm recognizing names. I'm picking up on things. And no, I've never seen or heard of Little Big Man.
It's my sincere hope that when you get a chance to see it, that you enjoy it. It's longer. It's a bit longer than the average movie, but I sincerely hope that you dig it.
Dan, I am going to watch it within a week, and I will message you and let you know how I feel about it.
Please do. I would love to hear your take, even if you can't stand it.
You got it, man.
Well, Dan, I have to say, as we kind of wind down here for the day, you know, we've had a number of people come on and do these My Favorite Movie episodes, and a lot of times it is a very pleasant experience, and when you sign off, you had a nice interview, and that's kind of the end of the relationship. But once in a while, we have a person come on and talk about a movie with so much fervor and passion and knowledge behind it that Brad and I kind of look at each other and say, oh, we have to have this person come back on the show, like in a guest hosting capacity. So I guess, you know, while I have you here on the hot seat, can I get you to commit to coming back for a full episode one of these days?
Oh, absolutely. Wild horses couldn't drag me away from that idea.
Yeah, I was going to say, heck, we should just bring you back for Little Big Man.
I'd love that. Obviously, it's a movie I've seen just countless times. And I've, you know, essentially memorized all the lines and what I'd learned actually just, cause I checked out the IMDb page a couple of days ago and I didn't realize that one of the main characters, an Indian chief, Native American chief, who goes by the name of Old Lodge Skins or Grandfather, depending on who you are in the movie, was originally going to either be Brando or Laurence Olivier. And I cannot imagine that.
Excellent
that
choices
worked.
Right there.
Yeah, beautiful, wonderful actors. But the fellow that actually played the part, Chief Dan George, an actual Native American, was not first choice, was not second choice, but ended up being nominated for Best Actor. He got an Oscar nomination for Best Actor, a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, sorry, and a New York Film Critics Circle. He won the Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor role from those guys for that role.
That's pretty incredible. Dan, before we let you go for the day, in your capacity as brand ambassador, yeah, do you have anything to plug? Anything coming down the pike from Glenmorangie that we need to keep our eyes out for?
Yeah, it's out now and it's turning out to be exceedingly difficult to come by. But if you can find yourself a bottle of Glenmorangie, A Tale of Winter, that is going to make its brief stop on retail shelves as we speak. Once it's gone, it's gone. And then it'll be next year. We also have released pretty recently a thing that we're calling Glenmorangie Grand Vintage 1997. It's in a slightly or significantly different price tier, but it's also a stunningly amazing whiskey. So those two things are about the newest things that we've released in the Glenmorangie portfolio. And they're both one and done's limited edition items.
Well, Dan, it has been just spectacular to have you on here. That, as soon as you said A Tale of Winter, I was like, I need to get my hands on that. It sounds like the greatest thing in the world.
It's pretty terrific.
Well, like I said, Dan, thank you so much for joining us. Guys, this has been Dan Kroll. He is the national brand ambassador for our favorite Scotch brand, Glenmorangie. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Dan.
Oh, Bob, Brad, thank you. This was a pleasure, and I cannot wait to join you once again.
We'll be back with another regularly scheduled episode on Monday, but until then, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And we'll see you next time.